Welcome back to the program. We're going to spend some time talking about a powerful new novel written by our guest, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Tinkers. It is my pleasure to welcome Paul Harding to the program for the first time to talk about his new novel, Enon. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
It's great to have you here. Enon is the name of a small New England town. Tell us about the locale where this story takes place.
Yeah, Enon is actually the original colonial name for the town that I grew up in, about 35 miles north of Boston. It's sort of a small kind of quintessential New England village. And when the idea for the book came to me, I sort of the idea arrived fully formed, and I knew right from the beginning that it was going to be basically set in that hometown locale, because I knew the landscape and the topography and the people so well.
Talk a little bit about that landscape, about that sense of a small New England village. When we think of New England, I think sometimes, at least the general public, doesn't think of towns like Enon.
Yeah, it's part of the reason I like to write about that area. Is because it's where I grew up, and it's where I just spent my whole life kind of knocking around in the woods and reading what I read and thinking what I thought. And so it's sort of imprinted on me, on the sort of molecular level. And one of the kind of wonderful and convenient coincidences of that is that, you have all of these other New England writers like Hawthorne and Emerson and Thoreau and Emily Dickinson, who also grew up in that landscape. And so to me, it's just sort of part of my inheritance, and there you have this great kind of intellectual and aesthetic and literary and philosophical tradition that kind of goes along with that New England landscape, and the seasons that are associated with New England, the autumnal kind of Halloween season, then the long winters and all that sort of stuff.
And the central character of this story is the grandson or great-grandson of your character from your previous novel, Tinkers.
That's right. When I first got the idea for the novel, I knew all at once that it was going to be not so much a sequel, but set in the same fictional world, and it was going to be the protagonist was Charlie Crosby, who is, as you said, the grandson and the great grandson of the protagonist of Tinkers. And I like that idea, partly just because I in my own life as a reader, I enjoyed, I'm particularly sort of enthralled with William Faulkner, and he is his Yoknapatawpha County, and so many of his novels are set in the same place, and even if you're reading, a book that's about a different protagonist, the minor characters will be characters from his other novels, and there's just this larger, kind of more spacious fictional world that you live in when you go into Faulkner. And that's the kind of idea, I kind of had that idea like, oh, it'll be good to have this world kind of persist over a number of books.
There is also this sense that in these kind of small towns, whether they're the small towns that Faulkner writes about in the South or the New England towns that you write about, this sense of people being related to each other, that these families, that people that have lived here and grown up here generation after generation after generation do have a connection, do know each other, do relate to the history of other families.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that sense, it's sort of like, it's almost like what Herman Melville does in Moby Dick on the ship, It's right. The sort of the family of man, as it were. And so everybody feels like they're related to each other. It's the old I and thou. It's the idea that, everybody is your neighbor, as it were. And so somehow or another, you're all connected and you're all sort of obligated to take care of one another. And yeah, it is that idea that not only do you know everybody, but your parents knew everybody and your grandparents knew everybody, and this sense of kind of interconnectedness, even if it's not explicit all the time.
And yet Charlie Crosby, who is at the center of this story, who suffers the loss of his 13-year-old daughter, is in many ways the opposite of what we've been talking about, because his life becomes so insular.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think when he suffers the loss of his daughter, what happens is that he just turns inward. He just sort of, his impulse is to just extract himself from the world. or at least from the kind of community that he's in. But he also remains, and he spends all of his days and nights wandering around the town, and in a way, sort of the town itself and the landscape becomes a character, in whom he sort of tries to find solace. And the actual other citizens of the town, it turns out, it's not really a spoiler alert, but, you know, it turns out that they're sort of in a very, very sort of tactful, quiet way, sort of watching out for him as well.
And at the core of this story, the death of his 13-year-old daughter is the kind of tragedy, and certainly people have talked about this in the past, this kind of tragedy that it's almost impossible to imagine. I mean, there's few things worse than the loss of a young child.
Yeah, no, it's true, and it was, you know, it was when I first had the idea for the book, my first naive kind of thought was, oh good, I've got a good spooky New England ghost story on my hands, you know. And then I wrote the first paragraph and realized, oh, this is actually just a, you know, kind of the most tragic tragedy you can imagine. And I think like most writers, when I realized what the real, you know, what the real difficulties and challenges were going to be to writing a book that was so tragic, my first impulse was just abandon the project. But then I realized, you know, that those are the actual challenges that make the book worth writing. You know, I like the idea that, it's usually a sign of substance when you feel like the book you're trying to write, actually you're not good enough to write. It's too difficult to write. And then the challenge becomes, well, the only way to become equal to it is to actually write it, you know.
Talk a little bit about your sense of that level of tragedy, what you understood about it, what you came to understand about it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I have children. I'm a parent. When I first became a parent, it was the first time I realized that, you know, something could happen. If something ever happened to one of my children, I had the sense that I wouldn't be able to survive the loss of a child. And I have very dear and close friends who have lost children, you know, and so it's just one of those things that when I'm up at night at 4 a.m. and can't sleep and worried about the world, those are the people I'm worried about and those are the things I think about. And so I just, again, just wanted to explore that kind of aesthetically. I'm a writer, so that's what I do. You know, I write books about the things that, you know, that are sort of the irreducible sort of mysteries in the world. And one of the things I realize is that if you have the dramatic premise of a parent losing a child, it has to be all about the character. The book can't be about, say, grief, as it were. It has to be about, in this case, Charlie Crosby. You have to write it from the individual soul experiencing it outward and pay very, very close attention to his experience moment by moment, because with something as sort of as frankly tragic as losing a child, if you make one wrong step in any direction, the book will turn into sentimental rot. You know, it'll turn into melodrama. And so I just wanted to make sure that I just didn't romanticize it or turn it into sort of like cheap sentiment, you know? And it was a challenge to live with him because it was tragic. And it was also, a challenge to live with him for those 3 or 4 years that I wrote it, because I wanted to just make sure that there wasn't a single false note in the book.
There's also this interesting contradiction that in some ways he tries to anesthetize himself, and
right,
yet he becomes at the same time hyper aware to almost everything around him.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So he anesthetizes himself by, you know, he drinks too much alcohol, and at one point in a moment of anger, he breaks his hand, and he's given a prescription for painkillers, and then he starts buying painkillers and then stealing them from, you know, his neighbor's houses and stuff. So there's that impulse to try to get a little bit of distance, actually, a little bit of emotional distance from it by doing that. But then at the same time, the idea that, I don't know, you know, I always think it's, you know, one of the cliches is that you see, you know, something tragic happens to you and you say nothing is the same ever, you know, afterwards. But actually what's the sort of what's so painful is that everything is the same afterwards, but you've changed, you know. So you still have to get up in the morning, you still have to do laundry, you still have to write your bills, you know, all that sort of stuff. And yet you've suffered this sort of tragedy. So it's paradoxical and it's irreconcilable. And that was one of the main things that I was interested in tracing over the course of the year, from when his daughter died until the first anniversary of her death, is how he sort of tries to manage going on, you know, the world going on while his personal world has fallen apart, essentially.
The other thing that seems to be something that happens repeatedly is that the first thing that happens is his marriage falls apart, which is so
right.
typical in these kinds of situations.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah, and his particular marriage was of a sort that he was married young, and the reason why the marriage lasted at all in the first place was that he and his spouse shared a common love for the child they had together. And when the child is taken out of that marriage, it just almost immediately evaporates. And I knew from the very beginning of the writing the, you know, from the very first pages that I wrote in the book that, that this book was going to be almost a soliloquy or a monologue, and it was going to be like a confession. It's sort of like St. Augustine, you know. It's him, it's just one voice confessing, you know, sort of his shortcomings and his hopes and his desires and his sorrow and his grief, but also his hope to the reader. So it's going to be very intimate, and it wasn't going to be so much about the marriage and about the other people. It was just this one person talking directly to the reader.
It's an interesting irony in these situations, because you would think that grief would bring people together in some way, and it has exactly the opposite effect.
Yeah, it's funny because it's, and you know, that goes back to, you know, making sure that I didn't write about grief first and then mm-hmm. try to sort of staple a paper doll to the ideas about grief. I think in his case, it really does, I mean, part of what happens to him is it just isolates him. You know, he just wants to retreat from the world. And the town in which he lives is, you know, sort of, people are tactful. There are people who make overtures to him, and he sort of awkwardly interacts with them. And he has the sense of knowing better. He has the sense of knowing that he shouldn't be isolating himself the way he is. And yet he just can't bring himself to sort of integrate himself back into the community.
Why does he stay in this town, do you think?
I think it's what he knows. You know, it's his milieu, it's his hometown. Again, it's the same reason. In some ways, Charlie, same why, you know. It's the same reason I stayed in the town. You know, it's sort of, he's kind of provincial and he's parochial, and it's what he knows. And it's what he's most familiar with. So even though he sort of isolates himself from the people, he is sort of bound to the landscape, to the place.
Right. It's interesting because you wonder why he doesn't just leave it all behind, escape from it in a physical way as well as an emotional way.
Yeah, it's funny. And I think that's, you know, that there are as many ways that people respond to tragedy as there are people upon whom tragedy befalls, you know, and in his case, it's just his impulse is to just sort of dig in rather than just kind of, you know, you just jump in the car and just leave, just keep on driving, you know? And I think he sort of does that emotionally and spiritually. He sort of heads out for oblivion in a way. But at the same time, one of the things that he spends most of the book doing also is taking, you know, he's kind of a dilettante or an amateur historian. You know, he's kind of an autodidact, so he knows all about the town's history. And so with that town history at his fingertips, one of the things that he does is he takes the memory of his daughter and he inserts her into that town history. So it's sort of, he's staying local, and he's staying with what he knows, and the way that he's trying to negotiate the loss of his daughter is by taking her memory and placing it in the world with which he's most familiar and comfortable, ultimately.
How did you avoid, personally, a sense of depression or melancholy in working on this for so many years?
Well, you can't, you know what I mean? I mean, it's a melancholy story, it's tragic, you know, but there are all sorts of literary and mythical precedents for it. You know, I thought a lot about Orpheus, and I thought a lot about Persephone and Demeter, and this is a very old story that I'm retelling about, you know, a parent or a lover, you know, somebody loses somebody who's very dear to them, and their impulse is to go down into the underworld and try to bring them back, you know. And so it's just fascinating in all those different respects to explore that. And also the idea that, you know, I knew from the beginning that no matter what happened in the book, that it was ultimately going to be a hopeful book and an affirmative book, no matter how modest the hope and the affirmation is at the end. But the idea was interesting to me, just as a writer, to work on the challenge of you put yourself in such a dark place and then you try to find some light, you know, but then the faith that you have is that whatever light you find when it finally shines is going to be all the more piercing and poignant and just beautiful for the fact that it contradicts the threat of darkness, you know, so that then when that happened in the book, that's kind of what I was writing towards, and that's the impulse I gave Charlie, that's the impulse I gave to the character, which is he, you know, in order to just not obliterate himself and dishonor the memory of his daughter, he tries to find a way to just come up with even just a grain of hope.
Paul Harding, his novel is Enon. It's just out from Random House. Paul, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you, man. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.